Hey guys, this is Phil, CEO of Ghostroot. I wanted to put something together to help you guys have a better understanding both of the service that you're receiving and the asset that you're accumulating. The current market circumstances are such that, you know, I felt it'd be good if I could talk to you each individually, but then also I wanted to leave you guys with something that would help you to retain principles, understand better, you know, how this asset works, what its implications are, and why current market circumstances aren't something to be worried about, but instead something that should make you more eager and optimistic for the future of the currency. I wanted to create a format for us to present information and present principles to you guys that you could retain, you could listen back to, you could remember, and that would be helpful for your interaction with this space in general, so you don't end up getting screwed by FTX or Celsius or whoever the next one is to go down. It is central to us to help you navigate the space better and make sure that you're staying clear of those kind of organizations and understand how to do so and why it is that those groups fail. And I thought that we could start by doing that by circling back. I know this is going to be covering old ground for some of you. Some of you might have heard it before, and for some of you it might even be cliche. But I thought it was worth exploring the concepts that Bitcoin is founded on and based on, which is just like, what is money? What kind of asset is this thing that we call money that we use every day? And what is it that you're getting with your service? Talking about the placement of Bitcoin within the history of money is what I wanted to do today. And I brought on my friend Kyle. Kyle is a maximalist friend of mine. He's done a lot of research on money, on finance, on Bitcoin. And I brought him on just to help me steer the conversation and talk about principles that we can explore together. So thanks for being on today, Kyle. How's it going?
Thanks for having me, Phil. Glad to be here.
I asked you before this to spend some time, like, you know, digging into, you know, money, right? Like the concept of money. I wonder if you could tell us, like, you know, just like a simple, but not simple layup question. What is money, Kyle? What is this thing that we call money?
Yeah, so I mean, we had so many different types of money throughout the ages. It's just a tool that allows us to exchange value between one another. So us as humans, we make stuff and we put it out into the marketplace. So before, in the olden times, we used to barter. We used to just trade items for items. If I made a pair of shoes and I go to the town square and I find someone else with a hat that I really want, then I'll be like offering, oh, you want these shoes for this hat? And then we make the exchange if it's voluntarily done so. But then it starts to get complicated as the human exchange network gets built out larger and larger. And eventually we need to use a tool to direct this exchange of value. And that's where we end up with using money. We have, like I said, a lot of different forms of money through the ages.
So money is a tool to exchange value. You can trade anything for money, and then you can trade money for anything, basically, right?
Correct.
We used to barter for goods and services. Why did we move off of this barter system?
Yeah, so if I go to you and I want to trade something, well, first, you might not even want what I'm trying to trade. Second would be that I'm not able to cut up this goat that I'm trying to trade into like individual pieces to just exchange a smaller value than the whole total goat. Another issue might be because I'm trying to move something over to the town square and it's just like way too heavy and I'm not even able to get it to you to exchange. And then also if like I'm growing fruits and vegetables, those things physically decay over time. So if I have a nice yellow banana trying to bring it to the town square and in the meantime while I'm doing that, it starts to decay and rot, it's in essence, losing value.
So there's a lifespan for the value of most commodities, and there's also a circumstance in which commodities could be valuable or not valuable.
Correct.
So we moved from barter to money because it was a better way to retain the value. You know, if somebody wanted the banana today, you could sell it to them, and then you would have the value of that banana at its peak, not when it decayed, right?
Yep. So like as a form of money, we need something that just holds value.
Okay. That's consistently going to be exchangeable for other things, even into the future.
Yep. And it's universally acceptable because like what we said, you might not want this banana that I'm trying to trade to you, but instead you want my US dollars.
We're all using currency. We're all using government mandated currency or government issued currencies, whether it's the peso, whether it's the euro, whether it's the dollar. Right now we're using a system of money which is issued by the government called fiat. And, you know, on your dollar bill that you receive, it says backed by the full faith and credit of the US government. The currencies that we're using today are issued by governments. They are not backed by any commodity in particular. They are purely fiat notes that the government says is worth money. but is not actually backed by a commodity. You know, you can't exchange it for a thing. We used to be able to exchange money for gold. Gold was like a dollar was a entitlement to $1 worth of gold at a bank or with the federal government. But we moved off of that system in the early 70s. Why did we move off of that system?
To fund debts, really. Government needed money. If they were able to print it themselves and give it to themselves, then they're able to have money and run political agendas. So essentially, it's like a tax on the people. Because if there's like $100 bills and you print out more money, then it devalues the currency at the cost of everyone else. But you're still able to get the money that you just printed out and then use it to go buy stuff.
By moving from the gold standard to fiat towards backless currencies, the government was able to settle its own debts, pay for loans, the services, and the goods that it needed.
Yeah, and I don't want to get like too sciencey, but gold is a commodity. It's backed by the laws of physics. And what that means is that there's only so much gold in the world. And the only way we can get more of it is by putting in physical work, going to the mining fields, and actually dig up gold and get like the ore out of the rocks. So because of this constraint, the laws of physics constraining you from being able to get more gold into circulation, it prevents any centralized organization or force to be able to arbitrarily debase the total supply, to devalue the total currency at the cost of anyone else.
So when we were on the gold standard, the government couldn't just issue more money because it would have needed to get more gold.
Correct.
And by being off the gold standard, the government's just now able to control the supply of money, you know, to decide how much there is in the system, you know, how much people are spending. And that gives them the ability to cover their own needs well. But that comes at the expense of this thing, debasement. What is debasement?
Debasement simply just means devaluing of whatever thing it is. So the way that the US dollar is devalued is by the increase of the total supply that's in circulation.
What's the impact of that? What is the like direct impact of an increase in the supply of the dollar?
Well, your $1 that you have now, after money printing or like a credit expansion in the technical terms, after that happens, your $1 is worth less.
So you can buy less with it because of this thing called debasement. And debasement just means...
it's money printing. Money printer go burr.
So there's a greater supply of money, meaning that like the relative value of $1 is less. So things get more expensive in relation to $1.
Yep. And that's called inflation. So it's always in reference to... it's like a relative term and it confuses people. And like, that's another thing with Keynesian economics and like centralized issued money. They used really technical words and they confuse us, like inflation. But essentially, that just means that price of costs and goods go up in relationship to the US dollar or whatever currency you use. It's even worse in third world countries. But given that situation that we're in where prices go up over time, this is kind of like a backdoor way that the government is able to tax our money without actually having to issue a direct tax.
What do you mean by that?
So a tax is just you have to pay money every year to the government or to whatever local community you're in to be able to pay for services that they're providing. Money printing is a way that they don't have to offer services. They don't have to actually do anything to benefit you, but they're still able to get money from you because they're printing more money and it's devaluing the money that you currently have.
So they have two streams of revenue, the government. There's tax, and then there's the issuing of more money.
Correct.
Okay.
And there's probably other ways, too.
Gold was a good form of money because it was scarce, because it was liquid, meaning that it could, you know, be used everywhere. Everyone was accepting it. And we moved from that to a paper money system where the paper was able to represent ownership of gold, which would be held in banks. And you could always go and redeem those, you know, government notes for gold with actual physical gold. And that was the case up until the early 70s. And then we move off of that system. If we were to try and design a good system of money, what would be true of that system?
Yeah, so historically, what devalues money is the money printing of issuing more into the total supply. So we want a money that has a hard cap supply. So just meaning if there's 21 million units in circulation as a total supply, then we don't want that total to increase, because then anyone that has that money has less purchasing power. Purchasing power just means that you want your $1 to hold its value over time and keep the value of the $1 into the future.
A good form of money is scarce.
Yep, and scarcity just means that the demand for that money is higher than the supply that it's provided. So this causes like the number go up, cause prices to increase. And like economics is built on scarcity. The reason why like the economy keeps running is because people have demand for certain goods and services. And so this is just what you're willing to pay for. And the more people that are willing to pay for that thing, the price of that goes up.
So with this is sort of the context, right, that money exists in, right? Like we want a scarce form of money. We want a liquid, usable form of money. We want to be able to send it when we want to. You and I know that sort of leads us to Bitcoin. You know, like I wonder if you could talk about like, you know, how is the Bitcoin network and the Bitcoin monetary system different than fiat and different than government issued money?
We have a digital ledger with the US dollar, but it's centrally controlled. And so it doesn't take much effort for someone who's at the top, the elite, to, i.e. the Fed, to go and change ones and zeros on the ledger to like change the total supply. So we need a way to secure the network. We need a way to decentralize it. And this is what Bitcoin offers.
Specifically Bitcoin mining, right? Is Bitcoin mining is how the issuance of new Bitcoin is decentralized.
To take a step back, we have nodes and we have Bitcoin mining on the whole total Bitcoin network. The nodes are the thing that keep track of the monetary policy. This just means that there's X amount of Bitcoin in circulation, and this is the basically like the declaration of rule set on the network. And then you have the Bitcoin mining side of it, which gets more Bitcoin added into circulation. Between those two things, that's the thing, that's what's causing the network to be secured and verified, just meaning that we're able to check with other nodes, other miners, and know that there's X amount of Bitcoin on the ledger. And then on top of that, the more nodes that are created to run this system, the more decentralized it is, meaning that the harder and harder it is for just one specific person to go in and just arbitrarily change the numbers and transactions on the ledger.
It's basically impossible to do that. Like you need an incredible amount of computing power to be able to do that. Like more than states have, you know, like nation states or governments. So like what is happening is money is being moved around from one wallet to another, and then every movement of Bitcoin from one wallet to a second wallet is tracked by both the nodes and by the mining units. Satoshi called them scanners, you know, proof of work scanners. Because this concept of mining is kind of hard, and it's it was added to the, you know, it's language that came into the system outside of the white paper, outside the Bitcoin white paper where the system was first described. So movement of funds from one wallet to another is encapsulated into a data unit called a block, which is secured with a hashing algorithm called SHA-256. And basically what's happening is you're putting all like a list of the transactions that happen into this box and putting that box through this hashing function, and it spits out a bunch of gibberish, letters and numbers that are sequential. The difference between nodes and miners is that miners are watching all the global transactions and they're trying to encapsulate all the transactions that happen into a block. When one of them successfully is able to solve that block and find valid encapsulation through a hashing function called SHA-256, it is able to then broadcast that solved block to the network, and then every node that receives that first solved block accepts it and moves on to the next 10-minute increment of transactions. When one of those miners is able to do that, they're rewarded with 6.25 Bitcoin right now, and that amount decreases every 4 years.
And I just want to point out that it's really important that the system doesn't have a lot of data, because then not everyone can run a node, because you don't have access to enough like hardware computation to be able to run the whole blockchain. So the more people that have nodes running, the more decentralized the network is. It just so happens, and through Satoshi's design, the data size of the Bitcoin blockchain is small enough so anyone with a Raspberry Pi can run their own node. And this is another aspect of the whole self-sovereignty to it, where it's ran by the people and there's no like central control over the network.
Bitcoin is a decentralized network because of this mining system, because of the system of, you know, computations which can be purchased, which can be run by anybody through computers that they can buy and that they can run, or at least they used to be able to before the power of these machines needed to be so great that it became impractical for someone to just run these in their home. By mining, you are serving as one of the people that's updating the Bitcoin blockchain. You and 2 million other individuals or 2 million other machines that are participating in this network. There isn't a central government that's authorizing it. It is a cryptographically secured system which is able to provide a greater level of security than the fiat system because of its design. The attributes of good money are, you know, it's scarce, it's liquid.
Scalable.
It's scalable.
Portable.
Portable, yeah. You can move it from one wallet to another without...
Indivisible.
Indivisible, yeah.
So that means that you can break it up into smaller units. So that's another thing, like, people are like, oh, well, there's only 21 million Bitcoin, but each Bitcoin is divisible into Satoshis, and then there's ways to even break up Satoshis into smaller units.
We try to focus on the sats that we're stacking, Satoshis or sats. Like, one Bitcoin is divisible into 100 million Satoshis.
So this provides more access for anyone to be a part of this network. Some arguments to Bitcoin would be that people think that it's harder and harder to be able to acquire Bitcoin, but the fact that it's divisible provides anyone to have access into having a fraction of a Bitcoin. And then when you own that, as the price goes higher and higher, you also get that price appreciation for that fraction of Bitcoin you own.
With the attributes of money being what they are, and the requirements of a good international monetary system being what they are, Bitcoin presents an alternative. And right now, the primary alternative, the first alternative to government issued money since we moved on to it in the early 70s, which involves a revolution of individuals participating in the network. Something I really like about it is how it doesn't take for granted that the government is in charge of the money supply. Like, why do we need government issued money? Why do we need a system where, you know, like, the same people that we don't trust to make laws for us are appointing people to control the monetary supply? They're human, they're fallible. But Bitcoin is different in that we're not trusting an individual or a regime. What we're trusting is code. It's a system that's built off of economic fundamentals, which strengthen it and prevent a stronger alternative than any form of government money that exists. When it is the primary means of transaction, which it will be because it's a better system, you know, governments can't control who is sending money. Governments can't control the introduction of new money into the system. It appreciates better. It's not subject to debasement the same way that fiat is.
Bitcoin transcends traditional business models because of its ability to be decentralized. So, like, traditionally, a business would have to have a CEO to be able to run the system, and there's certain management, like, at the top, and it's like a hierarchy, so to speak, to be able to have workers to produce the product. And then you take that same sort of model and you apply it to a money system, and this is essentially the fiat standard, where you have people at the top that are controlling the money supply and the money being the product, and they're able to have management around it, the Fed, and like dictate, oh, we're going to increase interest rates this year, or like we're going to do quantitative easing, which is like the money printing. But instead, the reason why I'm saying Bitcoin transcends that is because now it totally takes any human intervention away from having exposure to this asset class. And instead, it's able to have computers self-automated running on its own and keeping track of the ledger without any like human involvement. And this is all because of the decentralized aspect of this money system.
To wrap up this thought here, what we have with Bitcoin is a transition which is as significant as every intermediary step in the evolution of money before it. From trade to coins, from coins to dollars, from dollars to credit cards and digital money, and from government-issued digital money to this decentralized network of human-owned, not organizationally owned, stateless, bankless currency, which is Bitcoin.